The Production Expert Podcast is brought to you with the kind support of Autoria, Source Elements, and RSPE Audio Solutions.
Welcome to the Production Expert Podcast. I'm Julian Rogers, and in this week's edition, I'm joined by Katie Tavini and Russ Hughes, and we're going to be talking about clients. Katie Tavini is a Mancunian mastering engineer, now based in Brighton, whose credits include Emily Sandé, Arlo Parks, and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Since starting in 2014, the growing range of Katie's discography is testament to her versatility as an engineer. She's at home with everything from the heaviest metal to the lushest orchestral works, and everything in between. Welcome, Katie.
Hi.
Russ Hughes spent the 80s as a synth programmer for many top artists. He spent several decades writing and recording. In 2008, he founded the Experts websites, and after seeing many audio professionals didn't have access to high-quality content, the rest, they say, is history. Welcome, Russ.
Hello.
So, on to the topic of the day, clients. Before we talk about that, you need a business to bring clients into. So how did you start your creative businesses? We'll start with you, Katie. How did you get started?
Well, I don't really know. And I think for a long time, I didn't really know that I was a business or had a business. And, you know, it was probably only this time last year or something when I realised that, oh, I've got to get my shit sorted, because actually you know, this is a business. And it sort of dawned on me all like in a very short space of time that everything that I was frustrated about was because I wasn't treating mastering as a business. But I think when you're a creative person and you're working with people who are friends and are colleagues and, you know, making art, basically, you don't really want to think of it as a business because it sounds like corporate, and I don't have any business experience. But, you know, yeah, there was a lot of reading and research in a very short space of time to kind of get myself up to speed. So that didn't really answer the question, but I think that's how a lot of engineers and producers kind of feel for a long time. Like,
I actually think it did answer the question pretty well, but maybe not in the way we were expecting. You don't have to put a number on it, but absolutely. I think, Russ, this is something that you've touched on before.
Yeah, Katie has described what I talk about in my book as accidental business owners, and that's very common in the creative sector, that we don't get into this because we have some kind of master plan of being big corporate business owners. We get into it because we love what we do. Katie loves mastering and loves making music sound great, and some people like putting mics up all day, some people like songwriting, some people like it's almost, if we could do it for free, we would. That's the truth of this, but we can't because we have bills to pay. So there is a transition, and often it's a kind of a realization for a lot of people that, like, one day you wake up and think, shit, this is a business. I've gone from doing it for a few mates or doing it because I love it, and suddenly a lot of people want my time, and I've got to start thinking seriously about this, because unfortunately the bank don't take your friend's appreciation as a mortgage payment. They need cash. And so there is a point where that transition happens. And as Katie has quite rightly said, most of us, our expertise is creatives, not as business owners. And suddenly we have to go, well, what's corporation tax or what's VAT, and how do I register for that, or all these other things? Do I need insurance and all those kind of things? And they go through our mind. And one of the big ones, and I've had Zoom sessions with 20 or 30 top producers and engineers, and about marketing, and they've all said to me, we hate marketing. We don't want to do it, Russ. We don't want to sell. We don't want to do any selling. We don't want to do any marketing. It's almost alien to them. And on one call, they all said, Russ, can you just do it for us? Because that's not what they want to do. So often you're forced into a situation to do stuff you don't want to do, but it's a necessary evil.
So the wake-up call being probably getting some kind of tax-related letter and thinking, oh, wow, okay, and catching up with yourself.
Well, the wake-up call is probably hunger or the heating won't come on. Quite seriously. But it's interesting what Katie said, because my business, so let's take the blog, for example. The blog made no money for at least 3 years. I mean, zero. I mean, not a penny, not a dime, whichever way you want to use that, wherever you live. But the way that was possible, and this is what a lot of creatives do again, and if this was Katie's situation as well, is that we'll do a real job, quote unquote, we'll do a regular job, the job we don't really want to do, while we run our creative business alongside. So in the early days of my creative business as well, I was kind of doing two jobs at the same time. So I was probably working 80 hours a week at the worst point. And when you get to kind of 80 hours a week, that's when you realize that actually now you can probably jettison the other one and go for real. So I think that for many people, if you're just starting out, the chance of you going from zero to running a business is, in my view, highly unlikely. You're probably going to have to do a bit of both to keep the cash coming in. I don't know what Katie's experience was.
Yeah, I mean, my experience was really similar. So I've done bar work, I've done, engineering in studios and producing bands was like, when I was transitioning into mastering, that was kind of like work on the side, I guess, which is a bit weird, but, you know, that's what I'd been doing previously. And I did a part-time marketing job. I worked at the British Library on an amazing project called Unlocking Our Sound Heritage. I did that full time. And then I actually had that job as a full time job from, I think it was January 2018 until January 2020. So I did 2 years working full time on that project and having my studio and mastering every weekend and evening and having no life for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then eventually I went part-time at that job. And then when did I think I handed my notice in the middle of the pandemic. So bit of a weird time to sort of transition to going freelance, but yeah, I don't know. I think this like, This is my opinion. There's a massive taboo around having a job which isn't audio, and people think
you're
that
right.
You're not somehow proper enough.
Correct.
But the reality is, if you don't have rich parents or you live outside of London, obviously I am not from London, you know, you just can't afford to work, you know, for very little or for free, or potentially have really irregular work whilst you're building up your business and basically learning.
You're dead right. If you go to Nashville or to Los Angeles, there's one thing that becomes very clear as you're sitting in restaurants. The people serving you are either trying to be an actor or trying to be a musician, and they're trying to get by while those things happen. And I'm totally with Katie. There's no shame in working in an insurance company or in Tesco or whatever it is while you try and figure out your business. Because those are the people who will make their businesses work. Because those are the kind of people that think, there's a serious side to this. I've got to keep making money. And one of my bigger concerns is people who go, da-da, I've got a new mastering business, or I've got a new studio business, and they've spent a ton of money and I have no idea where the money's going to come from. It worries me when I see people do that, because it's normally a recipe for disaster and debt. So I'm totally with Katie on this one.
Interesting kind of backstory. We touched on something but didn't really go there, which is the subject of working for free. Have either of you ever worked for free? Is it always wrong to work for free? Is it necessary to work for free? What do you think? Katie, what's your take on that?
I have worked for free, and I would work for free again. But I think the main things that I consider, because, you know, it's nice to do stuff for charity. It's nice to do stuff that's a passion project. It's nice to do stuff for your friends, whatever. But I think you have to think about, if you're not going to get paid for your time, are you just volunteering your time and you're happy with that, or do you want some other compensation? Like, you know, will a credit on this project progress your career, for example? That's a really good one. And also, I think you've got to be really, really clear at the time of agreeing when you work for free how much time or what your commitment is going to be, because it's so easy for people to go, oh, you know, you mastered that record for free for charity at one time, and, you know, I'm doing my own project now and I'd really like you to master it, but I've got no budget. And then you're like, well, just because I did it once doesn't mean I can do it again. Or, and as well, I think another thing is, how busy are you? Like, I would probably not be able to take on a charity project if I was really, really busy, even if I was really into like the charity or something, just because the people that have already booked in and are paying for my time deserve like my full attention. So I think you've just got to think about it and be really clear and communicate, you know, with the people who are on the project or asking you to do stuff.
Interesting, because I mean, you were talking about a taboo around having a second job outside of audio, and for a lot of people, working for free also has a bit of a taboo around it. But you rightly say that it's more complicated than just kind of like yes or no to working for free. There's some nuance around that. Russ, what's your take on working for free?
I think sometimes we come at it from the wrong end of the street, because often what we find out, the people that usually get taken advantage of when it comes to working for free are people who are starting out. And the reality is that if somebody says, hey, can you come and help at the studio to make the tea because Kanye West is in for 3 days, making the tea in a studio while Kanye West was in it is never going to be good on a CV. Because you can't really say later on, I worked on Kanye West's album, because you didn't. You just made the tea in a studio. So the reality is that that kind of working for free looks like exposure, but in reality, it isn't. I'm totally with Katie again. Here's a thought. You can only give to charity if you've got money in the first place. That's my view in life. And so giving, let's take the word free out of this, and let's talk about giving, because that's effectively what happens when you work for free. You give of your time pro bono, as a lawyer would say. But you can only do that if you've got the assets in the first place, if you've got either the time or the money in the first place. So I've built a business to a place where it's successful enough that I can then make the choice to give some of my time for free to people who I think need it, or it's an interesting project. So I think the danger is that we all kind of, when we start out, we think, if I go and spend 3 days at Abbey Road doing something, that Abbey Road wouldn't ask you to do that, but you get my point. If I go and sit with this mastering engineer for a week and they don't pay me, then that's going to be good. But that might be good for education, for example. I've learned half of the stuff I know in this industry by sitting next to some of the best people in the industry. And so if you're going to work for free, have a plan for it. Decide why you are doing it, but never do it for exposure or credits, because generally at that end of the game, they're not worth anything. But if you're doing it because you want to really genuinely learn, so you say, I'm going to sit with Katie for a week and really learn the job of a mastering engineer and really understand it, and you've got some backup in terms of finances, so you can sit there for free for a week, then that's worthwhile. But don't do it because you think it's going to help your career, because generally, in my view, it doesn't.
Achoria has a wide selection of software effects, including 3 compressors, 3 filters, 3 preamps, and 3 delays you'll actually use. The latest release, 3 delays you'll actually use, includes Delay Tape 201, Delay Memory Brigade, and the unique and experimental Delay Eternity. A bundle of selected effects, called the Audio Fuse Creative Suite, is included with all Audio Fuse audio interfaces. Visit Achoria.com to find out more on the effects you'll actually use.
Well, I mean, it is time to talk about clients who actually pay rather than ones who don't. You're both in a position where you've got customers and presumably good ones. So what did you do when you found that you had a customer who wasn't one of those good customers, a good client? How do you deal with a bad client?
I don't think there's any such thing as a bad client. I think it's just like misaligned expectations. I don't know. Like, I think now this is where I have really strong opinions, and I really feel like the law of attraction is really, really real. And so if you're putting out something, then you're going to get it back. And if you're putting out something which isn't like dead authentic or whatever, then you are going to feel as though you've got sort of bad clients, but they're not going to be bad clients. It's just that you've attracted the wrong type of people. I think this, like, I hate it when engineers get dead competitive and see each other as threats, because I really feel like there's room for everyone and that everyone's totally, totally different. And each project, needs different skills. But it's your job to be as authentic as possible and show people what you can do so that they can find you and be the right person.
Interesting. So what you're saying is that there isn't such a thing as a bad client, but there is such a thing as the wrong client.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'm with Katie on that, because actually the way to get great clients is, I tell you what happens is that, and again, this will sound odd to a few people. Katie, shoot me down if you want, but I think we're kind of, we're coming at this from two ends of the same, to the same thing, to the two ends of the street, is that we think clients choose us. I choose my clients. And in a sense, it's kind of like betting on horses, is that I don't take bad clients on in the first place. I see a client, and if I don't think chemistry is there, or if I don't think that the ideas that we've got for the plan are the same, then taking them on is just going to make it a car crash from the outset. So I will do quite a lot of exploratory work before I even agree to do a project. And then often I will say, no, sorry, this isn't for me. It's not that it's a bad project or a bad client. It's just, if we do it together, it probably will end up like that. And so it is a kind of, Katie uses the term law of attraction. I think there's two things that need to be ticked at every occasion when you do anything. Competence, can I do the work? And chemistry, will we be able to work well together to get the best result? And sometimes one of those boxes doesn't get ticked. Sometimes two don't get ticked. So often the way I avoid bad clients is I don't take them on in the first place. That's my view of it. And because we often think that clients are accidental, that they just appear and we start working with them. But that we have a choice to say yes or no. And I can't remember which book it was, but there's a great book that says that our no's give us more opportunities than our yeses. And if we say no, it will possibly give us an opportunity to take on an even better project than the yes we've said yes to. So I'm just fortunate I can choose who I work with, which is really great. And I don't know if Katie does the same as me, but I will turn work down because I just don't think it's going to work out.
That's a good question, Katie. So does that happen often that you turn down projects?
No. So I think mastering's a little different because it's very quick. So for example, I can master an album in a day. And so you're not really spending a lot of time with the, you know, with the person.
There isn't
you're
a lot of time then. for the relationship to sour.
But I think, you know,
I have retained clients, so they're with me forever almost at times. Do you know what I mean? So well, there has to be a relationship.
I think people come back and that's really, really nice, and you build up a relationship over a few projects. But I never approach people and say, I'd like to work with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I
yeah.
feel like that's their call.
Exactly.
You know, if someone thinks I'm right for the job, that's amazing. I'm so honoured that they want to trust me with their music. Yeah. And I will do the best I can possibly do. Obviously, there has been times when I have turned stuff down. I turned down what would have been a number one album for a very large Manchester band. But I turned it down because I didn't think I was good enough, and I wasn't. And that's not me being imposter syndrome or whatever. I just did not have enough experience for that job at the time.
Sure. And so maybe ready rather than good enough, but yeah, yeah. Okay.
Well, it would have been shit of me to take it on knowing that I couldn't do, you know, the album justice. So there have been times I've turned stuff down, but...
I would guess then that would have ended up being a bad client because you'd have tried to overpromise on something you couldn't deliver. And then there would have been tears. And that's how you've avoided a bad client, because you didn't take it on.
Yeah, but I wouldn't call them a bad client. I'd call that just a unfortunate pairing or something. Because I think you can't really put that on the client. Like,
yeah, okay, let's call it a bad job then.
Yeah.
Just take the word client out of it, whatever Julian wants to use, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, this is interesting. We're talking about getting the right clients and this mismatch between you and the client or the project or however you want to put it. You will do your best work with the jobs that are best suited to you. So how do you go about communicating what your best fit is, attract the work that's best for you? Is there any principle that goes out in, I mean, I suppose we're talking about marketing here, aren't we?
I think track record is especially in the creative sector, track record's really an important part of this, is that if they see who you've worked with before and the kind of work you've achieved before, that's an instant sense of whether you're the right fit for the role and for the job and for the project. Because if, let's say, you've never produced R&B in your life or hip hop and all your entire repertoire is thrash metal, then I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's probably less likely that you're the fit for that job. Dom Morley wrote about niche this week, and I think that's so important, is that the big fear when you're starting out is if you go niche that you're going to not get enough work because you're going to close down avenues of possible income. But actually, when you're known for something, so Katie has nailed her colours to the mast and said, I'm a mastering engineer. She's not saying, I do a bit of mastering, a bit of recording, a bit of engineering. She can do all of those things, but now we all know Katie is a top mastering engineer. And so that means straight away they know what they're getting and the experience. So I think that's, you attract work often by the work. Ironically, as I say, I run an agency as well, and we never advertise, which is silly, which is mad. That's all we tell our clients to do all day. But because word of mouth does it, we just get emails and calls from people saying, can we work with you? Because we've heard about the work you've done. So I think, especially in the creative sector, I think that's a really big draw for clients.
So, Katie, is your back catalogue the main driver, do you think, for new work that comes to you?
It is now, yeah. But I think if you don't have that back catalogue and that word of mouth, you know, maybe say for example, if you've mastered three projects, then it's not so much about those, you know, having a credit on those projects, but it's more about showing people that you have worked on them and that you're available for work. And, you know, Russ just mentioned that I've kind of nailed my niche as a mastering engineer, but I'd go one further than that and say, I am a mastering engineer, but I'm not a big mastering house. I'm independent. I'm completely DIY. I'm a right weirdo. And I love cats and I love a good cup of tea. But if you communicate that to people, then people go, oh, okay. So if I come to you for my album, then you'll actually like engage me in conversation, for example, which is not always the case when you get your album mastered. So I think you've got to go one further than just sort of think about what the area you work in or want to work in, but how are you sort of different? You know, I did a really shit course last year. It was terrible because I wanted to know more about business and it was really, really bad. And I paid way too much for it as well, which made me sad. But there was one piece of this phrase just nailed it, and it was return on individuality. And I was like, okay, yeah, I didn't get anything else from the course. It was awful. But that phrase, I think, is really, really important.
Yeah. Well, we're back to chemistry, aren't we? That people want to work with you because you're unique. And I think uniqueness is so important in business. That the danger is everything wants to be homogenous these days. Everybody's just trying to be, there's that great line, I want to be different like everybody else, which is just brilliant. But I think... the danger is that everybody tries to do it. As I say, I'm not trying to flog my book here, but there's that chapter, Julian, Seven Dogs Chasing the Same Cat, which is the idea of everybody tries to do the same thing. And yet when you're trying to do the same as everybody else, you're in a marketplace where you're all fighting for the same work. So price goes down because that's the only thing that's the deciding factor. Whereas if like Katie, you say, okay, I'm a mastering engineer. I work on independent work and you get a good cup of tea out of me in a chat about cats. Then that's an offer. You can't say that's not a unique offer. and but the truth is that but you, what you've explained there is that every reason I always use mastering engineers and I will never upload to a service because I used Dennis Blackham for years at Sky Masters. He no longer does it. He retired a few years ago. But he was just sitting in a room with a mastering engineer and saying, what do you think of this? And they go, well, the bass is a bit weird, so let's fix that. And part of the mastering engineer's job, let's take mastering for example. Part of when you sit with a mastering engineer, you want them just to say it's okay that you haven't made a complete mess of what you recorded. And you can't get that from it. You can't get that from a homogenous service ever. They're just going to, I don't even want to talk about the technical side. The reason I used mastering engineers was never to do with the technology. It was always to do with the person, every time. And people are businesses. This is the bottom line. We're flesh and blood. We're not the kind of, all the stuff that you can learn on business courses. It's the flesh and blood that people buy. And that's what will get you business every time. And so the flesh and blood of who you are needs to connect with the flesh and blood of who's coming to you. And if it doesn't, then don't work with them because you'll end up with bad jobs. You'll fall out.
The Production Expert Podcast is made possible using Source Connect Now from Source Elements, the free way to record high-quality audio over the internet. Need to record an interview or a podcast like this one remotely? With Source Connect Now, you can. Using a Chrome browser, you'll get ISDN-equivalent quality audio without the need to install any additional software. Register for your free account at now.source-elements.com.
So how would you advise somebody starting out how to establish what they should be charging? It's a difficult question. Any easy answers there? Go to Katie first. What do you think?
I don't know, actually. Like, I did my first ever mastering job for free, and then the next one, I charged them £20 a track, and then once I'd done five of them, I charged them £30 a track, and then sort of, you know, looked at what other people were charging who had similar levels of experience as me. But I think it's really important to, you know, go and ask other engineers who are a similar level as you. Like, talk about rates, talk about money, because it's something that's really taboo, but you know, it's just something we should be really, really open about. And like, you know, I'd feel really bad if someone thought my rates were lower than what they are, thus they're charging lower than they should. And we were at the same level.
I wonder to what extent that's a British thing, just because we are sort of very reluctant to talk about, you know, vulgar commerce and money. But there is the value, perceived value argument, I suppose. I always talk about baked beans, which again is, I suppose, fairly British. But the value beans and name brand beans, and they're way more expensive. But the people who buy the name brand ones aren't buying beans, they're buying those beans. They're perceiving value in that, and that's why they're prepared to pay more. Russ, I'm sure you're going to have something on this. What would you advise people when they're trying to figure out what they should
I think they start at the wrong end of the first question you shouldn't be asking is not how much should I be charging, how much do I need to make, how much do I need to earn, what are my costs, and then work back from that. And if you, let's say you need to earn £30,000 a year, I was trying to choose a simple sum. I could let's say you need to earn £12,000 a year, so you need to make £1,000 a month, so you can then chop that down, and then you say what's the market value as well, and compare it in that, and then you see where you have to set yourself in the market. I hope that makes sense, because the danger is we go, okay, everybody's on Fiverr or producer.com or I don't know, cheapmastering.com, saying it's a tenner a track. Well, just because that's the case, that doesn't mean you can charge a tenner a track, because if you can't make a living doing it at that price, then you can't do it. End of story. You've either got to add value and up your rates or do something or go back to working in Tesco, because you can't, however much you love doing something, it's nearly as bad as working for free if you're working for a rate that can't sustain how much you need to make.
I'd argue so, it's possibly worse, because if people are paying you, then they have different expectations to if you volunteer.
Well, yeah, straight away they can tell you that they didn't like what you did, and can you do it again? So then you're on half the rate you were on in the first place. So, and coming back to your point, and I mentioned it again, the other thing, when I lived in Greenwich, we had I had a row of shops just round the corner. It was like little terraced houses. It was gorgeous. And at the end of those streets, there was a Tesco. Sorry, there was a Sainsbury's local. There was a Co-op local, and there were three supermarkets within 5 minutes walk of my house. And then there was this row of shops. And on a Saturday morning, there'd be a queue down the street to this row of shops. And what they were queuing for was bread. And it was sourdough. This was like 5, 6 years ago or 10 years ago. And these loaves of bread were £2, £3 a loaf. But you could go to the supermarket at the end of the street and get a loaf of bread for 40p. They're both bread. But the thing is, one had a perceived added value. And when you add value to a product, when you get out of the kind of loaf of the cheap and cheerful loaves of bread and get out of the everybody's mastering tracks for a tenner or everybody's recording for a fiver or whatever it is, and you have a point of difference, then you can start charging rates that actually you're worth. Because I think some people just think, well, the best way to get into business is to be as cheap as possible, and then I'll build up my rate. It's really hard to get your rate up. Really hard. Really hard. I remember when I started having to put my rates up, and it took me probably 2 years to get some of my clients off the old rate, because they said, well, why are you putting your rates up? And it was a quite legitimate question on their part, but I had to, but I'd set my price too low in the first place. And people don't take you seriously either. They think, well, if it's a tenner to get it done online and it's a tenner for this mastering engineer, so that they can't be very good. So that's, I think, the problem. So set your rates to a level where you can make a living.
Very true, very true. I remember a job that I priced wrong, and when it came to the next one, the client were really happy, but they came back and I had to renegotiate my rate up significantly. They passed. They weren't going to do it, and I was worried about doing that. But I replaced that work probably three times over with the time it freed up. And I ended up far happier about working for a reasonable amount. Yeah, it's true. Sometimes no is the right call.
I saw a great quote the other day by Walter Riggie, his friend of mine on Facebook. He says, you get what you charge for.
Mm.
And I love that line. I think it's brilliant.
Very good.
Almost attract that. Don't forget, the price is a message. That when you price something, so a Ferrari is £75,000, let's say, a cheap one. I could never afford that. So I could make fuss all my life saying, why don't they make a 10 grand Ferrari? They will never make a 10 grand Ferrari because they don't make Ferraris for people like me. And price is a message. And when you set a price, you're telling the world what kind of customers you want. And that's part of why pricing matters.
Are we going to talk about the elephant in the room here with that meme that's been going around lately?
Which meme?
I think we should.
The $50 client versus the $50,000
client. Go for it then.
Oh, I don't know.
Go on, describe it. Describe it for anyone who hasn't seen it.
Okay, so this meme is like $50 client. This is, you know, can you just do this? Can you do this? Can you do this? Loads of revisions, whatever. And then the $5,000 or $50,000, the expensive one, it's like... I'll take mix B, thank you.
Yeah.
And so it's implying that the expensive client is like better or more fancy or whatever.
But or maybe more secure.
Or maybe more secure, but...
It's got some manners, if nothing else. I said thank you.
I don't know. I feel like that is such a massive thing on the internet at the moment and kind of relates to this podcast, so we should probably talk about it.
Well, does that ring true with you, Russ, that meme?
Somewhat. I think what the meme was implying was when you work with cheap clients, they want more and more and more and more and more and never seem to be happy, whereas some of your clients that spend lots of money with you are incredibly reasonable and polite. Of course, it's a meme, so it's overstating something for humour. But... if people are laughing at it, it's possibly because there's some truth in it. Is that sometimes when, it's like you say, Julian, when you sometimes go out and try and do somebody a favor, it ends up being the worst possible job you've ever had. And you kill yourself and they're never happy. And yet some of your clients who are spending lots more money with you just seem incredibly reasonable. And so, yeah, I don't think there's... I don't think it's entirely factual. You can get a client that's a $50 client, of course, that's incredibly, loves what you've done. And that's great. I don't think it was, the implication was on the cost of the job. I think it was on the, when you do something for cheap, you end up paying for it normally.
Yeah, that was my take on it. My issue with it is that I've looked up quite a few people who've reposted that meme in sort of mastering circles, and they are all charging way too low. And so I feel that that meme actually reflects, them sharing that meme reflects the value that they have, or they see their own worth, which is not very much. Because people are posting it and being bitter about it. And I don't think they're going to sort of, if they're putting out that kind of negative vibe, they're not going to get the fancy client who's like, oh, okay, yeah, great work. Mixed beard is.
You get a $5,000 client by doing a $5,000 job. That's the reality of this. You can't be, if they're doing cheapskate jobs and then reposting that meme, then that's idiotic.
I think that's my frustration with it. Like,
is that like this? It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like drinking poison and expecting someone else to die.
Yeah,
isn't it? It's like if you're charging cheap rates and you're then agreeing with this meme, you've missed the meme entirely.
Yeah,
absolutely, haven't you? Absolutely missed it entirely.
It's just kind of blown my mind. Kind of watching that get shared around this past week. And it's made me kind of sad and frustrated and I don't know, like...
What did you see my rant about forums? That's how sad and frustrated I am this week.
Well, you know what? I also feel like the people who've shared that meme are the people that are sat on audio forums all day asking questions that they could Google, and they're sad about the fact that, you know, they're perhaps not where they want to be, but are they going to gigs? Are they making contacts? Are they, you know, reading a business book? Probably not.
They're not. You're right. I agree with you entirely, Katie. I think that's the case. The book I wrote is called The Book That Dad Told Me Not to Write. And the reason that he told me that is he said, when I went to ask him, should I write this book about your business wisdom, Dad? He said, no. I said, why? He said, you're wasting your time. I said, why? He said, because you can't put your head on their shoulders. And the truth is, Kate, you're exactly right, is that the people are sitting in forums all day bitching and moaning about that they can't make any money out of music, and yet all they do is sit in forums all day.
It makes me so sad because I genuinely want everyone to do well, and anyone who's got a passion for music, I want them to do well. And but then I'm like, well, okay, but you don't get it.
Well, that's the point. That's the point. The trouble is that I think when we go on things like Facebook or any social media and try and reason with people, we're trying to expect them to think like we think like, and they don't half the time. And so let's say they're going, oh, Trump's the most amazing thing since sliced bread, or Brexit, or whatever it is they're going on about. And I've got to the point now where I think I saw a great meme the other day that says, how many times do you type a reply on Facebook and then think, oh, fuck it, and delete it? Because you think it's a waste of breath and a waste of time. And I was actually genuinely I didn't read the comments on my thing about forums until this morning, because I thought it's going to just be an absolute shit show.
Oh, you should have seen the Gearspace thread on it, Russ. It was...
Exactly. But the point I'm making is I expect everybody to tell me what an idiot I was and how the world was fantastic and we should all be able to say what we like when we like. And yet, thankfully, when I went on there, it was all really great comments about, I've been feeling the same as well, and I feel a bit... I think the truth is, Katie, there's a whole other podcast on how we all feel about the industry in terms of there's just lots of people out there that are never going to make it because they're not going to make the effort to make it. They're just going to share memes all day and write in forums. Makes me sad, but I can't help them. You can't help them.
Well, I think we should move on to last question, we should probably keep this one reasonably brief. But what advice would you give yourself, your former self, about finding and managing clients? If you could talk to your former self, however many years ago, what would you say to yourself? Casey?
What advice would I give to myself? What is interesting? So I used to work part time in a marketing job, and I really, really wanted to go full-time as a mastering engineer, and I didn't for like a long, long time. And I wasn't applying the things that I was doing for this other company to myself because I didn't see myself as a business. So that's what I'd kind of, you know, give myself a slap and say, you should have done that sooner. But also, I think finding a good team and a good manager and stuff, like, especially if you're not particularly business savvy, that's been super, super useful.
Okay, excellent. So take yourself seriously and take the advice that you're giving to others. By the
Yeah, I mean, don't take yourself too seriously because that's boring. But yeah, definitely take the advice that you're giving to...
You'll end up in forums all day sharing memes if you take yourself too seriously.
Yeah, if you have ever posted a meme in a forum, come and send me an email and I'll snap you out of it.
Yeah, I don't think you will.
Russ, your thoughts?
It's very like Katie, actually. I remember that I was in these jobs where I was desperate to go self-employed and do these kind of things. And yet I was in these jobs. I was working in post houses, running post houses. And I kept getting really frustrated and really frustrated. And Anna, my wife, would say, you're worth more than this, Russ. And I would think to myself, no, I'm not. And then I went out with a friend one day and she is a life coach. And we were having lunch and I was bitching and moaning about how unhappy I was again. And she said, let me do you for free now at lunch and I'll do what I do for top managers and executives in companies. And we'll do a life coach moment on you. And by the end of the meal, she said, you shouldn't work for other people, Russ. You should work for yourself. What's stopping you? I said, the fear of being broke. I said, I'm worried that I wouldn't make any money and I'd be broke. She said, that's not a good enough reason. I remember that to this day. That was over a decade ago. And I came away from that meal and rang Anna, who was at work, and said, Anna, if I went self-employed, we'd probably be broke. Would you support me? And she said, of course I would, Russ. Whatever you want to do, just go for your dreams. And a year later, I was earning twice as much as ever earned before. So very like Katie, self-belief is the hardest thing in all of this. And often at the start, when you're on your own, there's nobody to tell you you're doing okay. There's nobody to tell you you're quite good at this. And imposter syndrome sets in so often. So self-belief, again, it comes back. Forums seem to be full of people who are just absolutely have. But this is what makes me sad, Katie, is that forums are full of people who think they're God's gift, but they're not. Attacking people who are God's gift, but don't think they are. And it really upsets me because there's some really great people out in our industry that haven't done it because they've just been hounded down in forums or on social media and told they're nothing or no good or don't know what they're talking about. Julian was told a couple of days ago when he did a YouTube video that he didn't know what he was talking about. I hate all of that discourse. It really upsets me. Often from dickheads hiding behind a computer with a fake name. It really just pisses me off. So if I can leave anybody with anything today, it's have some self-belief because that will really help you get out there and get the right clients.
Can I add one more thing, actually?
Of course.
So my one more thing is, if you can afford it, get a bit of therapy every now and again. Like, it really
dead
helps.
On. Yeah. Yeah. I've just had some recently. I'm happy to say that in public. I've recently had some counselling. So... We all need a bit. We all need a lot. I lost my dad this year and there's a lot of stuff in my head that needs figuring out.
It's time to move on to Find of the Week.
RSPE Audio Solutions design, sell, and install professional audio and video equipment. Their team are available by phone, live chat, or email to receive and process orders. They have everything you need to build or upgrade your home studio to ensure you can continue to work from home. If there is anything they can do to help, reach out or shop online at rspeaudio.com.
So, Katie, what's your find of the week?
My find of the week is not at all a kind of new find, but I think it's something that people can learn a lot from, and it's something that I don't think that people who listen to this podcast will be onto already, and that is RuPaul's Drag Race. And I feel like if you can bring...
I've never watched it. Is it really good?
Yes, it's amazing. But RuPaul has a lot of incredible phrases. the main one being bring your charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent to everything that you do. It also spells my favourite word there. I think that can be...
What was the acronym? I can't. What were the words again?
Charisma, uniqueness, nerve, and talent.
All right, okay.
So if you bring those things to everything that you do, like, that's something that I don't see people using enough, people who do, you know, music-related stuff. And I think it's really, really useful for engaging with people, networking, finding clients, how you treat those clients, how you see yourself, etc. So my homework to you guys is go and watch some Drag Race and put that into practice.
I am familiar with the Drag Race, and, you know, if you can't love yourself, how the hell anyone else going to, whatever else.
Amen.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we'll sashay away from that. And Russ, what's your find of the week?
I'm just writing down RuPaul's Drag Race now. I've never seen an episode of it, but it sounds fantastic, especially when he's using C-bombs to acronyms to explain live.
Oh, sorry.
Claro, another C is Claro, is this Sonox. I am so jaded with products, so I've spent my life in them. But when this came along, Julian, when you explained it, you did a really bad job of explaining it to me, because when you explained it, it sounded awful. But then I watched your video, which was a great video, on Claro is basically a new take on doing EQ from Sonox. So it uses words rather than it uses values. So it doesn't say, but rather than boost 3 dB at 100 hertz, you go a bit more warmth or a bit more clout or a bit more, do you know what I mean? So you're using much more artistic words to make mixed decisions. And then, so that's the first part. So that's kind of like the dumb way of doing it, which I love because I'm from Birmingham, so I've never got an education. Mm-hmm. So I love doing audio like that. And then it shows you what you did. And the most, and Julian, I was the same. Most remarkable is when you've done all these moves and it sounds just how you want it, you then see visually what it looks like. And you think, I would never have visually made an EQ look like that. But it sounds great. So you're mixing with your ears. And then the third part is, if you put it on all the channels of a mix, it can then tell you where they... what they call the hotspots are, where there's kind of like bunching of EQ. So you might want to take bits of EQ out of each different instrument to make it work better. So it's a kind of part smart EQ, part educational device. It's really clever, really easy. It's as I say, in terms of plugins, there's too many out there already, but this one is brilliant and well worth checking out.
No, agreed, definitely.
Is that a good, did I describe it?
I think you did, so. Absolutely. And it's that thing that it does so well is just kind of talks about or kind of references sounds in the same way that we do when we talk to each other. We don't, most of us, even if we're talking to other audio people, don't say, oh, I need a, you know, 1.5 dB at 3K15. It sounds a little bit, that sounds quite an aggressive move, actually, to sort of say that.
Well, it doesn't mean anything really, does it? What do you really know what that means if I say it to you? Whereas if you say, could you put a bit more air in that vocal? You think, yeah, a bit more air.
Yeah, yeah.
That makes sense.
And I really like the way it has the positive words associated with parts of the frequency spectrum above the curve and the negative words at the bottom. Because that's really nice. You see these things and kind of like anyone reading these kind of, you know, there's various things that show words around parts of the spectrum. And anyone reading those might think that, you know, 250 hertz is always bad. And I mean, it very often is, but it's not without its place, you know, and it goes.
It's kind of like for a lot of people, a lot of plugin EQs are like Excel spreadsheets. This is like a Photoshop of EQ for me.
Mm.
It's much more artistic.
Yeah,
you could never hurt to use your ears for a change.
It's difficult what they were trying to do, and I think they made a really good job of it. Just because there was lots of ways they could have got it badly wrong, and I think they came through pretty unscathed.
Do you have a find of the week, Julian? That isn't Korean mayonnaise.
Well, I mean, Korean mayonnaise is my find of every week, but I randomly met somebody in the audio industry in a place I didn't expect to meet them at all, which is a pub very local to me, but in West Cornwall, so hardly, you know, LA or London or something. One of his companies is a company, a new company called Odd Sound, and they make this thing with a great name for the company, terrible name for the product, the MTS ESP suite. And what it is it's like a master tuning, a master tuning control for MIDI and instruments and basically everything apart from audio. It's not like Melodyne, but You can do micro tuning and move away from even tempered stuff, which you can do in some instruments, but you can do it globally across everything, which is like, you know, it's a bit niche. But way more importantly, I think, you can just use it like a master tuning control. So while you can tune, you know, if you've got something off tape, for example, and it's like an eighth of a tone flat, and everything that you're trying to play over it sounds a little bit, you can pull it down or pull it up. It's really clever the way it works. And the uptake across quite a few sort of, you know, industry people has been really quick for something that's only been around for, you know, part of this year. So if you're into kind of, you know, MIDI production particularly, then check out Odd Sound MTS ESP Suite. Interesting thing. Okay, with that, we better wind things up. So thanks to Russ, thanks to Katie, and we'll be back next time for another edition of the Production Expert Podcast.